Chairman, this is the Senate Judiciary and Public Service, or Public Safety Committee, a little out of practice this morning. This is our first informational hearing of the year. We usually have these in the interim, and what we do is we discuss issues that may be pertinent, and the issues before us today involve the judiciary reform. Items and issues that have floated around for years in Minnesota, they come, they go, and we thought we'd have this opportunity to have an academic discussion about some of the changes that some people would like to see in the state of Minnesota. There's a little bit of an order today. First, what we'll be doing is we're going to be giving time limits to those who are proponents of ideas, and then we've asked individuals in the judiciary branch of government to give a perspective, a historical perspective of the same issues. What has the state considered over the years? Why are we at the point that we're at now in judicial practice? And if there's any need for any further change. The areas that we're going to be talking about is first, Senator Newman is going to bring us through a number of judicial reform issues that have been kind of floated around, as I said, for a few years. Among them are going to be mandatory retirement ages for judges, incumbency designations on voting ballots, and that discussion may run us into another issue or two. After that, we're going to be talking about the recent passage of the judicial election runoffs. Some of you may know that we have runoffs now, just as of a few months ago, the legislature passed, kind of in response to what happened in the 10th Judicial District, with 20 candidates all running for one judgeship. That there probably would be a need, even though it's rare, there would be a need for a runoff and try to encourage a little larger, at least plurality, if not a majority of a vote, rather than a small token slice of the electorate. And then thirdly, we're going to cover the history of Judicial Standards Board, Code of Ethics, of Judicial Conduct and Ethics today.
If you're here to discuss If you're here to discuss the judicial retention election that's been floating around, we're not going to go into that discussion today. But we're going to focus on these other issues. Now, there are a few items that I would like to lay some ground rules. Some of the proponents I've talked to over the years and some people are rather passionate about some of these issues, and on the other side, they're equally passionate. I hope that we all would respect each other's opinions and have a dignity to our discussions. In addition to that, we will not be taking testimony from public at large. We've asked the proponents have sought out hearings. We're offering them an informational hearing today, and we have allocated a time frame for each side to be equally represented in time. If you're not on the testifier list, we will not be asking you for any opinion verbally in front of or orally in front of this committee. But if you have written testimony, we will make sure that every member of the Judiciary Committee will get a copy of it. What is the time limit that we have established? We're going to 1 hour for each topic, and then that amount of time will be equally split between proponents and opponents, or those who want to give a historical perspective. I want to be respectful of anyone from the judiciary branch who is simply offering not an opinion on the bill, but a historical analysis of it. But that will be part of the time factor. Oh, and also for members, we have three specific areas of discussion. And I would ask you to hold your questions until the end of each segment. That way we can keep an eye on the clock and make sure we're giving the people that are coming before us an opportunity to be clearly and completely heard. To begin, we're going to be talking about judicial issues, a variety of judicial issues, and Senator Newman. Would you like to do that from your chair here, or would you like to go to the testifying table?
I will go to the testifying table, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
And forgot to turn my phone off.
Yeah, I probably did, too.
I should be safe now.
All right.
That's always
And members, Kathy Pontius included a review of the subjects that are in your packet. And if you'd like to follow along or read that as we go through testifying, you're welcome to do so. Senator Newman, welcome back to the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, for the record, my name is Senator Scott Newman. Representing the McLeod, Meeker, and Wright counties here in Minnesota, and I am a member of this committee. I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to come forward with you this morning and give you my perspective on this issue, and I will do my very best to be cognizant of the time restraints that we are working under. I'm here to talk to you about two bills of which I am the chief author. The first is Senate File 627, which is a bill that has two parts in it, one which would amend the mandatory retirement of judges, and secondly, which would remove the incumbency designation from judicial ballots. The second bill is Senate File 1097, which addresses the issue of when elections must be scheduled in the event of a judicial vacancy. In order to help you follow my line of thinking and what I'm doing, I'm going to try and give you a little bit of historical background or perspective from my standpoint. And for me, the starting point is the Minnesota Constitution going all the way back to 1857. I will tell you that I have read the debates that occurred during the Constitutional Convention. You may find this odd, but I thought it was kind of interesting reading. The debates, I will tell you, were very, very lively. And what ultimately occurred was the delegates ultimately decided that in the state of Minnesota, what we are going to have are judicial elections. And the Constitution regarding the judiciary has been amended a number of times over the years, I think about six times the last time I counted. None of those constitutional amendments ever affected judicial elections. So I think it's safe for us to assume that from 1857 to date, the fact that we have judicial elections in the state of Minnesota have remained the same. And this is what the current language in the Constitution says, and I want you to keep this in mind. Term of office election. The term of office of all judges shall be 6 years and until their successors are qualified. They shall be elected by the voters from the area which they are to serve, and keep this in mind, in the manner provided by law. Vacancy. Whenever there is a vacancy in the office of a judge, the governor shall, that's mandatory, shall appoint in the manner provided by law. In the manner provided by law, that's you, that's the legislature. Shall appoint in the manner provided by law a qualified person to fill the vacancy until, and I emphasize the word until, a successor is elected and qualified. Retirement. The legislature may provide by law for the retirement of all judges. The legislature. part of the purpose of what I'm trying to accomplish here is to get the legislature back involved in judicial elections. We have been derelict in our duty in doing so. And we have left the setting of elections for judicial positions almost exclusively up to the Supreme Court. And I think that we have made a mistake in doing that. The problem that we have is that our Constitution, according to what I just read to you, clearly indicates that we are to elect our judges. But in point of fact, that isn't happening. We have created, within the state of Minnesota, a de facto appointment system. And just to illustrate that fact for you, let me just share this with you. There are 7 Supreme Court justices. The only justice on the Supreme Court that's ever been elected without having first been appointed is Alan Page. There are 19 judges on the Court of Appeals. To the best of my knowledge, none have ever been elected without having first been appointed. There are, I believe, 283 district court judges in the state of Minnesota. With the exception of a handful, and I mean a very small number, all have been elected only after they were first appointed to the office. And I would be willing to bet that the percentage is something between 90 and 95%. So there's a very, very small number of judges within the state of Minnesota who have run for election and are true incumbents. So the question becomes, you know, why do we care? I mean, I think it's fair to say that we have a real good judicial branch in terms of the quality of our judges in the state of Minnesota, and I think that's a fair statement. There are exceptions to that. But on the whole, our judges are good judges. So why do we care whether or not we are going to rock the boat, so to speak? And I'm going to go right back to the Constitution. The Constitution is the law in the state of Minnesota that trumps everything. It trumps regulations. It trumps rules. It trumps the statutes that we pass. It is the bedrock of our democracy, and we have to follow it. And I think we have to follow our Constitution whether we agree with the terms of it or not. And if we do not agree with the terms of our Constitution, then there is a provision to amend it. And we, in my estimation, are clearly not following our Constitution when it comes to the selection process of judges. And I believe that to be an extraordinarily dangerous precedent in the state of Minnesota. Now, this de facto appointment process, I will tell you, I'm not much of a conspiracy theorist, so I'm not going to make any allegations that this process is by design or by unintended consequences. I will tell you I don't know, and I frankly don't care. But I'm telling you that it is there. And this de facto process, in my estimation, has occurred with 3 separate processes going on at the same time, in concert. Number 1 is Canon 5. Number 2 is the incumbency designation. And number 3 is the mandatory retirement of judges. Canon 5 is a rule. The Supreme Court adopts, interprets, and enforces rules, which is what these canons are, concerning the conduct of lawyers and judges. And Canon 5 is the rule adopted and enforced by the Minnesota State Supreme Court that governs the conduct of judicial candidates. And historically, Canon 5 has been very restrictive in what judicial candidates can say about current issues of the day that are important to the voters, and very restrictive on the ability of candidates to raise money in order to run for elected office. Let me just give you an example as to a statistic that I I looked at in 2004. Now, it's somewhat outdated, and things have changed a little bit. But in the 2004 judicial, or I should say general election, in the first judicial district, there were 184,000 voters standing in the voting booth that left the judicial ballots blank. 40% of all of the voters in the first judicial district who voted in the other elections left the judicial ballots blank. And I believe that they left the ballots blank because they didn't know anything about the candidates. And the reason they didn't know anything about the candidates is because of the restrictions placed on the candidates through Canon 5. To illustrate just how restrictive Canon 5 is and why I think it's important that you as a legislature become involved in judicial elections, I'm going to give you a quote out of a case that came out of the state of Minnesota and went all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And this is what the U.S. Supreme Court said about the Minnesota State Supreme Court regarding its involvement, the Minnesota Supreme Court's involvement in judicial elections. Quote, without apparent constitutional or statutory authority, the Minnesota Supreme Court has stepped into the legislative arena in an attempt to regulate the political climate of statewide elections. Now, they're speaking specifically of judicial elections, but to me that is a stunning condemnation by the U.S. Supreme Court concerning the conduct of the Minnesota State Supreme Court when it comes to judicial elections. And to me, that simply illustrates the fact that we have got the fox guarding the hen house. The Minnesota State Supreme Court is the body currently that is very involved in regulating judicial elections. And it's because of this kind of conduct that I am recommending that the legislature become much more involved in judicial elections. The second piece is the incumbency designation on the ballot. Now, I'm talking again about the de facto appointment system. The second piece is the incumbency designation. That statute is, I believe, in your packet, and it simply says designation of incumbents of incumbent judicial offices. If a Chief Justice, Associate Justice, or judge is a candidate to succeed again, the word incumbent shall be printed after the after that judge's name as a candidate. I am truthfully not aware of any other candidate in the state of Minnesota for any elected office that has given that advantage in an open and free election. And I truly don't understand why it is there. I think that the judges like it because it gives them an advantage. But I also think it's a severe impediment to open and free elections. And in my view, it is very simply a job retention tool to be used by the judiciary in having incumbents reelected. And I simply can't imagine a member of this committee seriously believing that you would support an incumbency designation on your reelection campaign. I don't think it would happen. But it is embedded in statute. And so what we have then is a hurdle for a candidate who wants to come forward and run in a fair and an open election against an incumbent judge. And it simply is not a fair level playing field. The last part of the de facto appointment system is the mandatory retirement statute. And that statute says very simply, mandatory retirement means the last day of the month in which a judge has attained 70 years of age. It's important to note that this is the manner in which the vacancy is created in order for the governor to make the appointments to the bench. This is the tool where the vacancy is created. And truthfully, think about this. Can you think of any other elected office in the state of Minnesota at any level where the elected official is prevented by law from completing their elected term? Because I can't. And I simply believe that what we should do as a legislature is remove the incumbency designation and level the playing field for judicial candidates and allow elected officials, judges, to complete the term that the voters have elected them to. Now, some may come forward and say, well, you know, that's getting pretty old, you know, for judges to be serving after they're 70 years of age. And if you think that that's okay with me, reduce the mandatory retirement age. I don't care. The Constitution gives us the authority to do that, and the Supreme Court has so ruled. But on the other hand, I will tell you that it is embedded in the Constitution and a normal practice for the Supreme Court to bring retired judges back after they have retired to continue working. So I really don't think we are going to jeopardize the value of service of judges if we simply allow them to complete the term of office to which they were elected. So what I have done with regard to Senate File 627 is in Section 1, simply allowing the judges to complete their term of office. You will note that there is language in there that is the, it talks about the official year of the state. And when this bill was drafted, I didn't have a clue what that meant. And Ms. Pontius bailed me out, and we find that the official year of the state is defined in the Constitution, Article 7, Section 7, that deals with voting, the elective franchise. And so we decided to use that term because it is very, very specific. But all we're trying to accomplish in Section 1 is allow judges to complete the term to which they were elected. Section 2 is the repealer of the incumbency designation that I have talked about. The other bill that I wanted to mention to you or briefly visit with you about is Senate File 1097. It's a little bit more complicated in terms of the language, but I'm going to direct your attention to statute. That wish to look it up. It's statute 2.722 subdivision 4. 2.722 subdivision 4. That's the statute that gives the Supreme Court the authority to determine whether or not a judge's position, a seat, they call it, that we're either going to continue it or we're going to discontinue it or we're going to transfer it. We're going to move it someplace else. And I really think that's probably a pretty good idea because I would think that the judicial branch administratively knows where they need to put their people in order to get things done. So in Senate File 1097, what I'm trying to do, and I'm open to suggestions, but what I'm trying to do is have the legislature become involved in judicial elections, and when are they going to occur? So Part 1 begins at line 1.19 through line 1.24, and that's where a judicial office is going to become open shortly before a general election. And I'll tell you a real quick story of why.
Newman?
Yes?
Just to give you a friendly reminder, you were given 15 minutes.
How long have I gone?
You're at about 17 and a half minutes.
Give me 2 minutes and I'll wrap it up.
It's your time.
Mr. Chairman.
It's your clock.
Thank you, sir. The reason I put that in there is in 2006, up in Anoka County, there was 3 new judgeships created by the legislature. Governor Pawlenty appointed those 3 new judges in the summer of 2006. We then had a general election in November, and the judges were sworn in December. And the thought crosses my mind, why didn't we have an election? Why didn't we elect those judges? The following, and I've got to go, I'm going to leave it up to the members to read this bill, but the following parts are, I'm asking the legislature to become involved in setting the times when the actual judicial elections are going to be held, because I think that we have an absolute right to do that. And the cases that I've looked at, which I do not have time to discuss with you, are pretty inconsistent in determining when a judicial election is going to be held versus when an appointment is going to be made. And it's up to, right now, it's up to the Supreme Court, and what the Supreme Court is relying on is a statute that is very indefinite. I'll tell you what the statute is, and then I'm going to wrap it up. It's statute 490.126, subdivision 2. And all it says is that the judge is going to be elected as provided by law. But it doesn't say what that law is. And that's the statute that the Supreme Court is relying on in case law to determine whether we're going to have an appointment or an election. And it's very inconsistent. And I am suggesting that the Constitution provides that you, the legislature, have the right and the responsibility to do what I am suggesting, and that is become involved in judicial elections and in the judicial process, because I'm going to take you right back to what the Constitution says, in a manner as provided by law. That's you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Newman. The next person would be Judge Robert Birnbaum. Welcome to the committee, Judge. As you're getting settled, I just wanted to remind the public that this particular hearing will be recorded. It's a video as well as audio. It'll be online on the state government website, so you can pull it up there. And we can help you in my office if you need to have an exact website address. And also, a reminder of the public, this is an informational hearing, so there will be no votes on this, any of these proposals today. Welcome to the committee, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee,
would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Excuse me?
Would you identify yourself?
Yes, my name is Robert Birnbaum, and I'm a district court judge in the 3rd Judicial District. Again, thank you for giving me the time to speak to you today about the issue of judges' retirement. I am chambered in Olmsted County, and I was appointed to the bench in January 1998, was elected in 2000, and reelected in 2006. In addition to my duties in the 3rd District, I am the chair of the Minnesota District Judges Association Pension and Benefits Committee and a representative for the 3rd District on the MDJA Board of Directors. MDJA represents trial judges throughout the state for issues such as judicial compensation, retirement, elections legislation, and continuing education through the Minnesota District Judges Foundation. MDJA has a long tradition of consulting with and working with the legislature on issues of concern to judges. Those issues have included pensions and retirement, as well as judicial compensation. Most recently, MDJA participated in the process of legislative enactment of some of the first in the nation pension changes that improved the financial viability of public pension funds without additional costs to taxpayers. These changes have already added significantly to an improved financial outlook for the major pension funds. The MDJA board adopted at its October meeting a set of principles recommended by the Pension and Benefits Committee that would govern our approach to proposals for pension and retirement changes in the future. Among those principles are the ideas of continuing to manage pensions based on sound financial and economic principles and practices, and that all similarly situated people be treated the same. In accordance with these principles, MDJA has viewed issues related to mandatory retirement as related to pensions and not elections. The bills currently proposed affecting judicial retirement age would have a substantial impact on judicial elections. Mandatory retirement, presently age 70, was adopted at a time when concerns existed about an individual's cognitive and physical abilities to continue doing the job as they age. The policy was not adopted with any idea of affecting elections. Faced now with increasing longevity and improved medical care, we know that many people can continue to function just fine after that age. Recognizing that fact, the judicial branch continues to make use of the valuable resource represented by senior judges who are called on to serve at both trial and appellate courts. MDJA has been open to talking about mandatory retirement for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that having more people working longer could contribute to the financial health of the pension plan. But we do not consider this an election-related issue, and it should not be. Determining the right age, if any, to set for mandatory retirement is difficult and complicated at best. It requires objective, empirical data that will support a policy of ensuring that we have hardworking, competent decision-makers on the bench. A law that promotes retirement with an eye towards ensuring replacement by election has its heart elsewhere and treats similarly situated people differently. For example, under the current proposal, Senate File 627, a judge who turned 70 on December 31, 2012 must retire that day, while a judge who turned 70 on January 1, 2013 can remain on the bench until the end of 2014. Over the years, a relatively small number of judges have chosen to stay on the bench until 70. Since 1986, there have been 55 judges who have retired as a result of reaching 70 out of 436 retirements, resignations, deaths, or other reasons that resulted in a judicial vacancy. That is a rate of 12.6%, taking mandatory retirement over a 26-year period. There is also some indication that the rate is going down, with 29 of those 55 mandatory retirements occurring in the first 11 years, 1986 through 1996. Of course, as with any group of workers, the reasons for leaving the bench vary, including death, moving on to other pursuits, family obligations, health, or simply deciding it is time to retire. In summary, on behalf of MDJA, we ask that any consideration of changes to judges' retirement age be done in the context of pensions and ensuring a competent bench, not as part of any effort to affect or promote judicial elections. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Judge. And next would be Judge Jeffrey Thompson. Judge Thompson, welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Jeff Thompson. I am a district judge in Winona. I'm the assistant chief judge of the 3rd Judicial District and here today as the chairman of the MDJA Elections Committee, Mr. Chairman. I did provide I think you all have a copy of a handout to be distributed, which is just sets the statute and sets the three cases that have discussed incumbency and its constitutionality. I agree with Senator Newman. This is a legislative issue. The legislature has the power to decide these questions. But I would like to provide some historical perspective. In 1948, a constitutional convention was called to discuss, among other things, the selection and retention of judges. Selecting and retaining judges is unique. We want our judges to be qualified, we want them to be impartial, and we want them to be accountable. Certainly, as the assistant chief judge involved in judicial administration, I want my judges to be accountable. I want them to work hard. I want them to play fair. I want them to be able to cooperate with others so that we can get our work done. And we have a lot of work to do. Judges need to be qualified. We want to be able to attract good lawyers and good people to the bench. Lawyers have to give up lucrative practices to become judges. And we want judges to be impartial. And that was the challenge offered at the Constitutional Convention in 1857, at the Constitutional Convention in 1948. What does it mean for a judge to be impartial? And by and large, what it was felt to mean was that we want judges not to be partisan, not to be identified by political parties, so the judicial office is nonpartisan, and we want to eliminate, at this point, the need or the potential corruption of large amounts of campaign cash. The recommendation of the 1948 Constitutional Convention was to adopt a Missouri-style retention election system. In 1949, the legislature acted on it. That was, by the way, the year I was born. And I would say that while at one point in time I thought 70 was pretty old, as I get closer, I don't think that anymore, although my eyes aren't as good as they used to be, and so I can't actually read some of these name tags. The response of the legislature was, in 1949, not to adopt retention elections for Minnesota, but instead to designate on the ballot for judicial elections only the fact that the sitting judge was the incumbent. This has been challenged. It was challenged the very year, next year, as a constitutional matter. It was challenged in 1994, I believe, in the Peterson case. That was a very well-researched case, and I would say that at least in Peterson, it was clear that all of the judges on the Supreme Court were special appointees who were not going to run for election again and would not be affected. And the decisions have always been that this is a legislative decision, but legislature in 1949 and legislatures that have considered the matter since have concluded that this is information that is important for the voters. This is not a judicial retention matter. This is not a job security matter for judges. It's important for the voters so the voters know who is the judge currently sitting. If that judge has a bad reputation, and some have, and deservedly so, that judge can be voted out. Otherwise, that voters know that this person has the kind of experience, has, in most cases, as Senator Newman said, gone through merit selection, which is a legislatively mandated process now for the district court, gone through merit selection, been appointed by the governor. Merit selection is a complicated process, the idea being to get down to the three best candidates of those who apply, let the governor appoint, and then let the sitting judge stand for election after he or she have had a year to adapt to the lifestyle, and it's a considerably different lifestyle, adapt to the job, and it's a job that requires some growth, and then stand before the electorate. And the idea is, again, to keep out partisan politics and to keep out the corrupting influence of large amounts of campaign cash. There may be those who think that partisan politics and campaign cash are important in judicial elections, and for them I'd simply point to our neighboring state of Wisconsin, where even this year there have been very political Supreme Court fights. The Supreme Court election was not so much on the qualification of the sitting judge, but considered more, by the national news at least, to be a referendum on the governor, which should have nothing to do with whether or not the judge is elected or not, and had led the Wisconsin Supreme Court to the point of dysfunction where the claim was that there was actually some kind of wrestling match or assaultive conduct during their deliberations between the justices. I don't want that for my bench, and I certainly don't want that for the Supreme Court. I suspect if that was true in Minnesota, Justice Page would get his way on just about every decision. Minnesota has long been recognized for its capable judiciary. We have been asked, for instance, to go to nations developing democracies such as Kosovo to help them understand the role of the judge. And for these reasons, and I'll keep this short, the MDJA is against the removal of the incumbency designation. I would also say that I have in my research looked and seen apparently references to a constitutional convention in 1972 where, again, the recommendation was for a retention election system. Minnesota, according to the Supreme Court in the Peterson case, has decided to go its own way, and this is the system we've chosen, and that includes the incumbency designation for the election. Chairman?
Thank you, Judge. Next individual, Greg Wurzel. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Wurzel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Greg Wurzel. Wurzel's W-E-R-S-A-L. I'm a practicing lawyer. I've practiced for over 30 years. I have run for judicial office. And I also was a lead plaintiff in the Republican Party of Minnesota versus White case, which established which is the case that was referenced that went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court and established the right of judicial candidates to state their views on legal and political issues. I would like to add just a few facts to the presentation that's been given. I'm sure that the legislature had good intentions when it put the word incumbent on the ballot. And I think that was done in 1949. But I think we need to now look back and say, what did it accomplish and what actually happened after you did that? And I would maintain to you that what you've done essentially is shut down the entire judicial election system. No incumbent judge on the Minnesota Supreme Court has been defeated in an election in over 50 years. Now, I want you to think about that, because if we were talking about the legislature and we said that no incumbent had been defeated in an election in over 50 years, you would say there's something definitely wrong with that election system. No incumbent on the Minnesota Court of Appeals has been defeated in an election since the court was created in 1983. And if my math is right, I think that's about 34 or 35 years. Now, recently, we have had some district court judges lose some elections. In the last election in 2010, two district court judges lost election. One was a judge out of Goodhue County who actually had been suspended by the Minnesota Supreme Court because of ethical violations. I want you to note, however, that while that judge lost at the general election, he made it through the primary. There were three candidates in the primary, and the incumbent judge, because of that incumbent designation, got the largest number of votes of any of the three candidates. We're lucky he lost in the general election. The other was a judge in Anoka County. The history, if you look at the history of judicial elections, and Mr. Chairman, I wasn't sure exactly how much time I was going to be given.
You have, Mr. Wurzel, until 10:08 by that clock.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think I'll need that much time.
Oh, I'm sorry. It will go till 10 o'clock.
Very good, Mr. Chairman. I'll make my comments fit that time. If you look at the history of judicial elections, you will see that about 40% of the people vote for the challenger and about 60% of the people vote for the incumbent. And that happens in election after election after election after election. And if you look just at the elections in 2010, you're going to see that occurred. In 2010, a challenger named Roxanne, and I think it was Klugman, ran for the Minnesota Court of Appeals. And to be honest with you, I can't remember the name of the incumbent judge off the top of my head, but neither she had held any position before. The incumbent judge, if I remember right, had actually been appointed to his position, and this was the first time he was standing for election. Neither of them spent any money at all on the election. I'm sure that the voters had no idea who they were voting for. The incumbent got 60% of the vote, or thereabout, and Ms. Klugman, spending no money, got 40%. I ran in that election. I got, I believe, 42% of the vote. The incumbent judge I was running against got the balance. Another attorney that I can think of ran as well. And again, if you look back in the history of elections and go back, you're going to see that 40-60 split, 40-60 split between the word, the challenger, and that word incumbent. I say to people, when you're running for these offices, you're not running against a judge, you're running against the word incumbent. The final comment I'd make is we need a process. I disagree a little bit with Senator Newman here. He gave a glowing view of the judiciary. I think we have 10% of judges who are excellent judges. Maybe it's more. We have a whole bunch of mediocre judges, and that's fine. And then my view is that we've got a good 10 or 15%, maybe even 20% of judges who are bad judges that we need to get rid of. I've run across them in my practice, and they are out there. I've seen judges who said they will not follow precedent, even though clear precedent was put in front of them. And these people need to be replaced, and we need a mechanism to do that. We need something that's going to work. The Constitution says they're supposed to stand for election, and that's why we need an election system that works, and this one simply is not working. My last comment, Mr. Chairman, is the Senate Council did some research, and they discussed the case of Clark versus Pawlenty and its discussion of the incumbent designation. I'm familiar with that case. I want you to know that in that case, it was an election challenge, and election challenges in the state of Minnesota go directly to the Minnesota Supreme Court. They are the court of original jurisdiction. They allowed Ms. Clark no opportunity to submit any evidence at all, and then they issued a decision saying that she had failed to supply facts to support her allegation that the incumbent designation affected the outcome. I am currently in the process of putting together a federal lawsuit to challenge the incumbent designation. I hope that this committee will do the right thing and remove it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wurzel. Next person, Mr. Bon Clayton.
Mr. Chairman, Greg Wurzel and Scott Newman have covered all the ground that I was going
to. Okay. Thank you. Committee, we have about 15 minutes for questions to any of the people that had spoken on this topic area. So if you have any questions, now would be the time to raise them. Senator McGuire, I can always have faith.
Always count on me. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You can always count on me to have some questions. I could start out with Mr. Wurzel, who just testified. So I have a question for you. Thank you. So we all want elections to work as well as they can, and I think, you know, information to voters is always really helpful. And so there are, I think, ways that we can make elections more, you know, fair and productive. I'm just wondering, do you think really that having the word incumbent is helpful these days? I mean, I'm not sure that it is actually helpful. A lot of people are frustrated with, you know, the way things are going, and I would say, like, if elected officials had the word incumbent, it would probably be not so helpful. So this may be just a query, but do you think that they'll know more about the person when you don't have the designation of incumbent on there? They're still not going to know very much about either of these candidates if they haven't done their voter education. So if you don't have the word incumbent, they don't know any more about the person seeking, you know, challenging as they do the incumbent. I mean, they still need voter education. So I'm unclear why this removal of incumbent is more helpful.
Well, first of all, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, The word incumbent is a significant impediment to having excellent candidates run for this office against judges who we desperately need to replace. Whether you want to believe it or not, again, if you look at the history of what has occurred in these elections, that 40%, 60% split, that advantage that you're giving to that incumbent occurs again and again and again and again. Now, you are correct that the voters don't have a lot of information, but understand, no attorney in his right mind is going to run for a position he doesn't think he has an opportunity to win. So right now we have a ballot where you will see perhaps 80 or 90% of the judges running unopposed. Very few, and I'll give you an example. The incident that just occurred in the 10th Judicial District where I think over 20 attorneys ran, there were many incumbent judges on that ballot that were not opposed by anyone. But there were 20 attorneys who saw an opportunity where they weren't going to have to run against the word incumbent, and they ran because they saw an opportunity where someone could actually win. So you got to build the ballpark if you expect the players to come, and the ballpark isn't there right now. I think most attorneys don't see the opportunity, and therefore there's no information really flowing. The other part of the problem, of course, is the significant rules that limit free speech, that limit campaign conduct that were created by the Minnesota Supreme Court, which were referenced as Canon 9. You need to understand shortly after the White litigation, the Minnesota Supreme Court changed some of those rules and relabeled them now as Canon 4, not Canon 5. So if you go do your research, you're going to want to look at Canon 4. I hope I answered your question.
Thank you, Mr. Worsley. Any other questions? Sir Jungbauer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess to Judge Jeffrey Thompson on the same issue of incumbency. Thank you, Judge. I wrote down one of your statements that voters need to know who is serving now. And I guess I'd like to understand when we took incumbency away from legislators, what is the difference between a judge and a legislator in terms of the public needing to know who is serving now? And that was actually a pretty good comment, because I think some people, if the word incumbent and legislators appeared, they may not get back in. But I really wondered, because I think the same thing. We took it away from legislators because we knew that was an advantage. But why would the public need to know? You said the voters need to know who's serving now.
Judge Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, it's being a judge, the position of judge is different than the position of a legislator or the governor for one big reason, and that is judges should be and are required to be to run nonpartisan. And I used to be the county attorney in Rice County, and that was a nonpartisan office. Most of the county attorneys that ran were reelected, and I used to say, well, part of the reason I didn't have any opposition after the first time was people saw what I had to do and didn't want to do it. Most of the other attorneys just didn't want to be involved in what I was doing. Being a judge is different than being a legislator. We are to be impartial, and that means we don't get to go out and campaign in the same way that a legislator does. And once we become judges, we have to go through a process of training and experience and education. Well, in order to become a judge, you have to be qualified in the law, learner of the law. That means graduate from a law school. We like the judges to have some experience as trial lawyers. As an administrator, I like to have judges to have some experience as trial lawyers before they become trial judges, so that they understand what the trial experience is about. It's a different position, and so that's why I think that it's important for the voters to know. There are judges, and there have been judges, and I can give you examples some a more appropriate time, who have been what we call suffering from robitis, maybe, who are arrogant and arbitrary. But those judges get a reputation for that, too. And that reputation goes out to the public. And then when the public's thinking, well, I understand that there's a judge, maybe, unfortunately, a judge in Winona, who has got this autocratic personality. And the people I talk to say that he's not a very good judge. Then it's important that when they go to vote, they know that that's the judge they're talking about. And they know that because he's labeled as the incumbent judge. Otherwise, I think the incumbency designation goes to simply advise the public, this is somebody who has, in most cases, well, has in all cases some experience as a judge, but in most cases, as Senator Newman has pointed out, has gone through the merit selection process.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Judge. I think that would make sense if people could actually get information about judges, and I can think of a specific case not that long ago when a judge in Carver County actually fined somebody for putting out information about him on the web. And I thought, well, if a judge has that much control that they can actually go and find somebody that puts out factual information about them or any kind of as legislators, we have to put up with any kind of fabrication even that somebody puts out about us, and we can't do anything about it. But in this case, somebody's putting out some information about a judge, and they have that kind of control. So how does that help if that kind of information isn't allowed to be out there?
You know, I don't know the case you're talking about, but I find it hard to believe that that judge would be able to get that fine enforced and that would survive an appeal. The other thing that I think is important for everybody to remember is that at least at the trial court level and the court of appeals level, all our decisions are subject to review, and they're subject to pretty strict review, and we all take, most of us take that pretty seriously. And so we work very hard to make sure that our decisions are appropriate.
Well, Senator Jungbauer, would you mind if I interject a question?
Sure.
You had stated that running for election judge is different than any other office. However, due to the fact that it's a nonpartisan race, but there are many nonpartisan races that are on the ballot, county commissioners, a whole variety of city councils, school board elections. We don't place incumbency after their names. So what would designate a judge being unique from that particular candidate that's another nonpartisan race?
Well, there are lots of nonpartisan races, and most of those races are very local races, one city or county, where the candidates are fairly well known. They're not very well known in the district wide. In a district like I'm in with 11 counties, they're not that well known. I don't have any problem with somebody running against me in a district-wide race. I think it's more troublesome if we were to go to smaller jurisdictions. I think it would be more troublesome for lawyers to run against sitting judges. But in a district like the 3rd, there are plenty of lawyers in the 3rd district. And if they did run, I would have to run a campaign to tout my own qualifications. But the incumbency designation serves to let people know this is a judge who has been sitting and has a record. Inquire about it if you have a question.
Senator Newman, I have a belief that the incumbency label is probably, as Senator McGuire has mentioned, is kind of a double-edged sword. It can hurt as well as help. But the question that I wanted to ask you is, are there any other states in the country that prohibit the use of incumbency as a label on a candidacy for judge? In your study, have you gone outside of the state?
Mr. Chairman, in response to your question, I don't know the answer to your question. I don't know what other states are doing. As to the incumbency label being a good or a bad thing, as pointed out by Senator McGuire, I would suspect that maybe currently, given the feelings of the electorate. Having an incumbency designation might currently hurt. But culturally, you know, there's an ebb and flow. There's an ebb and flow. And over the long haul, I believe that the incumbency designation on the ballot really does help judges become elected. And and if you just look at, if we assume for a moment that the statistics that Mr. Wurzel cited of 60-40 over the last how many years, that would be a pretty good indication to me that if you have an incumbency designation on the ballot, in all probability, you're going to win.
Thank you. Senator Jungbauer, you have last question. We've got about 2 to 3 minutes left for the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess I was kind of taken aback by the judge's comment that certain things may not survive a challenge in terms of bringing suit, because I think, in fact, in all the cases I can think of where judges had that robitis, and I could give you a couple examples personally, I think the judges know that when they say those kinds of things, folks don't have the money to go out and challenge judges, and I think, in fact, did a lot of study, I think in most cases you literally can't challenge in terms of statute. I don't think there's any statutory way to take a judge to court. You can challenge a decision, but you can't take the judge to court for their actions is the way I'm reading statute. And that was why when you put the incumbency there, I think there's no way for people to really get out the kind of information as to whether or not that's a good or bad judge, and I think Senator Newman made a good statement there that they don't have to put out money. You look at the only case here, Washington County, 24 people ran for an open seat. There were 17 other seats with incumbents, and only one was challenged. There must be something to that. So I don't know. Maybe you can answer to the history of how many people do get challenged with that incumbency with those kind of statistics, I guess.
Well, Judge, we got about a half a minute to go through that history, and I'm really trying to honor the balance here.
Mr. Chairman, if I could,
if you
just
want to take a stab at it, you've got about a half a minute.
I would, and I appreciate the time. Senator. My response is that first we have a lot of people in court these days, and it's a very interesting experience. Who do not have lawyers and who do not have a lot of money, and those people go to the Court of Appeals too. And everybody has the right to appeal a judge's decision, and judges get appealed all the time. The other thing is there are a lot of positions, and I think it's a tribute really to the quality of Minnesota judges that most judges aren't challenged. And to the extent that the incumbency designation helps us attract good people to the bench, I think that's very beneficial. Mr.
Chairman. Thank you,
Judge. Mr. Chairman, if I could have 15 yes. seconds and then we're done is the final word as the author of the bills. I will tell you that I was passed a note in answer to your question that the designation of incumbency on the ballot is not present in any other state in the union except the state of Minnesota.
I think we're going to listen to the testifier at the table.
The final.
He'll have the last word at this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The what I wanted to say very, very briefly is that what I want you to do as legislators is come back to my original position. We've had some discussion on the merits of whether the current election system is good or bad, and no matter how long we debate it, there are going to be folks on both sides. I simply want you to go to the Constitution and look at it and become involved in judicial elections like the Constitution directs us to do. Do not abdicate your responsibility to the Supreme Court. Become involved in judicial elections. That's why I brought these bills forward, because I want you to look at these issues. And to me, this is more of an academic issue. I'm not attacking any judges. I'm simply saying the Constitution is not being followed, and I am asking you to look into it and to enact appropriate legislation so that we abide by the terms of the Constitution. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Senator Newman. The next issue will be regarding the recent passage of a bill regarding election runoffs for judiciary races. And I'm going to ask researcher Alexi Stengel to come to the table to tell us, Ms. Stengel, what did we do last year? And then we have two people to give testimony regarding the recent election in the 10th Judicial District. And as long as the committee doesn't ask me a lot of questions, we will not dedicate an entire hour to this issue. They may want to grill me a little bit more, but why don't you go ahead, Ms. Stengel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, my name is Alexis Stengel. I'm Senate Counsel for the Local Government and Elections Committee. And I'm here to talk to you a little bit about what was Senate File 1009, which became Chapter 65 of the laws last year. And it came about in general in response to the 10th Judicial District, which we've been hearing about a lot. So let me give a little bit of background. Perhaps the testifiers might fill in a little bit more. What had happened there, two candidates had filed for the judicial vacancy by the end of the filing period. After the filing period closes, there's a two-day withdrawal period, and that's set by statute. And during those 2 days of the withdrawal period, both of the candidates withdrew. So at the end of the withdrawal period, there was no one left. That created what was called a vacancy nomination. And that triggered a new filing period for people to file their nominating petitions. And that's when you got the 24 people that filed. And the way statutes were written, there was no primary, there was no runoff, there was no anything. So those 24 names went on to the general election ballot and split all sorts of different ways. And that was sort of the problem we were addressing, were all of these people on the general election ballot. So this bill changes that to some degree. And the biggest change is now in that same situation, instead of all 24 of those names going on to the general election ballot, there would first be a primary with the winners of the primary going on to the general election. There were also a few other changes. That filing period to fill the vacancy was reduced to 5 days. Petitions of nomination are no longer used. Instead, people would file an affidavit of candidacy just like they would do for any of the other positions. There are a few other little things in the bill, taking out some cross-references, making some changes to conform with the timelines and those sorts of things, but that's the bill in a nutshell.
Thank you, Ms. Stengel. At this time, I'd like to ask Chris Penwell, and I might as well ask Judge Tad Jude also to come to the table. And we'll start with Mr. Penwell. Thank you, Mr. Penwell.
Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chris Penwell, I practice with the downtown law firm of Siegel Brill. I've been a business litigator for about 27 years, so I'm a courtroom attorney. I've been in front of many judges throughout the state in federal court and in federal and state courts across the country. So I'm a very experienced litigator. In addition to that, I was one of the 24 on the ballot back in 2010. And the first comment I have is, why didn't you pass this law in 2009? Because there was a Saturday morning where I was minding my own business, and I got a call from a partner of mine who said, did you hear about the open judge seat in the 10th Judicial District? And my wife and I talked it over, and at that time you had to get a petition signed by 500 people, and we had about 4 days at the point that I made the decision. So we ran around and got signatures on the petition, and, you know, we guessed maybe we thought, 8-9 people might also get petitions who would be crazy enough to go out in a few days and try to gather 500 signatures on a petition, and then to find out that there were 24 people on the ballot. The good thing about that was that it was a curiosity and an oddity, and I believe unprecedented anywhere, and so it got a lot of attention. A lot of attention was drawn to that election, and it got a lot of press. There were a lot of letters to the editor. 19 or 20 of us went down to Channel 5 and appeared on their newscast. So I think the good thing about it was that it drew a lot of attention to judicial elections and a lot of the things that we're talking about here today. But ultimately, in the end, there was too many people or too many candidates for voters to really get any meaningful information about any one of them. We had two candidate forums that were put on. One was put on by the one of the Tea Parties, and the other one was put on by another group. Something like 15 people or so showed up for those forums. And it was they each got questions, and they answered the questions. And you can imagine that spreading questions over 15 people, I mean, we had maybe a couple of minutes or less to answer each question, and there was just no way for people to really sort out who was who and who stood for what and so forth. So the great thing about limiting it to two people is that people will be able to get meaningful information. And there's been a lot of comments today about people's frustration over the lack of information about judges. And I think that certainly accounts for why a lot of people don't vote at all in many of the elections. And I think why a lot of people just either vote the incumbent or, more recently, there's been a toss-out the incumbent movement, and so they vote for the non-incumbent without really knowing anything about who the candidates are. And with two people, and I know there's been some movement to limit the election to only the county in which the judge would sit. In my case, it would have been Washington County, so that if the election had been limited to Washington County and you only had two people, and he had opportunities, debates, and forums, and that sort of thing, people would have gotten lots of information about the candidates, and they would have been able to make an informed decision when they went into the voting booth. So I don't know, Mr. Chair, if there's information that you want in addition about my particular experience. Judge Jude was also in my election. I was actually the Republican-endorsed candidate, but in the end, I was no match for the Jude for Judge juggernaut. And he prevailed in that election by a landslide, but it was a great experience. It was really I took 2 months off of work, which was ended up being, you know, it's somewhat costly to put aside your private practice for 2 months, but the difficult part was that there were Eight counties going all the way from Wright and Sherburne County all the way over to Washington County and then north all the way up to Pine and Kanabic County. And I put probably about 200 miles a day on my car for that two-month time period. As I say, if we could limit it to the county in which the judge sits and get it down to two people, we would be able to get information to the voters from which they could make an informed decision. And my experience was that people want to retain their constitutional right to vote. It's very important to them. I heard that over and over again. They just wanted to know more about the judges. As an attorney, I always get a lot of calls from people, how do I find out about these judicial candidates? How do I get information? And so, again, I think the good thing about my race, the election I was involved in, is I do think that it increased in most people's minds, at least in those eight counties, the importance of getting good information and doing the research. There's judicial candidates have websites, and a number of the newspapers allowed the candidates to post their bios and some information about their candidacy and so forth. So there was a lot of information, and we're moving in the right direction. And I really want to stress the importance of preserving our constitutional right to elect judges. And just so I don't forget, I did put together a short, concise website that discusses a number of the topics that have come up today, and that is electjudges.wordpress.com. It definitely advocates for preserving the election of judges. It discusses the Quia Amendment as I say, a number of the other topics that we've discussed today. But I would encourage you to take a look at that. That's at least my views on these subjects, and it does come out of my experience both as a litigator for 27 years and out of my experience as a candidate in that race.
Thank you, Mr. Penwell. Judge Jude, welcome back to the Senate.
Thank you, Senator Limmer, and it's a privilege to be here. I had thought of you being a state senator 25 years ago.
That's correct. And, for those of the audience and the members, Judge Jude and I ran against each other in 1986 out in northwest Hennepin County.
But I'm pleased to see you're chair of the Judiciary Committee. And,
we've had private discussion, and we've become very good friends. So I'm delighted to have you in front of me right now. but I think in a conversation we once had after 1986, neither one of us wants to run against each other ever again, because we pummeled each other pretty good in 1986.
Well, I'd like to thank Chris Penwell. First, he was a very good candidate, and the candidates who ran in the 10th District last year, I think, were exceptional candidates. And the public eventually did get to know the candidates, even though it was a huge district. It runs all the way from Cokato to Sturgeon Lake, from St. Cloud down to Hastings, Stillwater, Anoka, Elk River, that whole territory. So it's a huge area. But there are 24 very well-qualified people who, first of all, had 10 days to go out and get 500 signatures. And not only had to be signatures, they had to have the date you were born. They had to have information, you know, identifying who they were so the Secretary of State could validate that they were registered voters. And the 10th District hadn't seen a competitive election for a long time. There was just a huge amount of education involved in getting each one of those signatures. And there were tens of thousands of signatures that had to be gathered. So there were many long, lengthy educational conversations held between candidates and the public just to get on the ballot in a short period of time. And following that, of course, it was kind of like this instant runoff election process where all the candidates go on in November. It was on steroids because we had 24 candidates. No one knew how many candidates would be running when they went out and got these petitions. And, of course, I had some very good helpers. Gail was my campaign chairman. She's here today. My campaign manager, Ben Hedberg, was my treasurer. He's here today. They'd be available to help answer questions. But in the end, it was very, very much an educational process for the candidates and for the public. And in the end, we had ended up printing hundreds of thousands of pieces of literature. I know there were like 46 parades, 46 newspapers, many letters to the editor, at least 20 websites, I think, were up. There were blogs, there were Facebook pages, there were candidate forums, visiting to nursing homes, senior citizen residences. And in the 10th District, that really hadn't been done before. So it was very good, I think, for the general public to see the judicial branch as an independent, separate, and equal branch of the government, similar to the legislature or similar to the race for governor, because those type of discussions were taking place. You'd get questions about what does the district look like. I mean, are you going to be sitting out in Buffalo, or are you going to be up in Elk River, are you going to be up in Anoka, are you going to be in Stillwater, are you going to be up in Mora? They'd ask what kind of cases would you hear. They'd ask, you know, obviously what your qualifications are. What is your background? They just wanted to know more about the judiciary. And it was a very good discussion. I know some of the legislators here were involved in that. I ran into Senator Newman a few times, Senator Youngbauer ran into you a few times, Senator Goodwin, I know we crossed paths up in Anoka County. And it was a good experience. I think it was good for the public. It was confusing. You know, I appreciate the legislature passing the bill to focus the field. And you'll probably have to do that, too, where you have instant runoff voting as well, where you have many candidates running going to November. If you ever came into a situation where you had 20 people running, you'd need to focus a little bit more than gets focused now. We have a number of candidates running until November. So I appreciate the work of the legislature in doing that and look forward to any comments or questions you might have.
Any questions? I've been waiting for Pat Jude to be in front of our committee. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome back to the Senate, Judge Jude. Say, did you run with party designation? I'm just curious. This is sort of not, you know, I'm just curious about the whole party designation and running on issues. And yours was an election that did all of that, right? And so I was just curious about that.
I did not have party endorsement. And, of course, the office doesn't have designation. And I'm so old. Right. When I first was elected to the legislature, it was a nonpartisan legislature back in 1972. And I sought DFL endorsement in 1972, and I lost. And I won the election. This year I sought support from the Republican Party. I lost. I won the election. And a lot of that was because I knew a number of people in the district. I knew county board members. I knew city council members. I knew legislators, people who had been in the legislature. I had support from many former Democrat and Republican legislators from both parties. And, of course, the job is a nonpartisan job. It's one where in the whole educational process you speak to as many groups as you can, and that's what we did. You know, we spoke to many, many groups, you know, both political parties, and it was very well received. And particularly senior citizens. I mean, senior citizens, you know, had been affected. You know, their families or their property or their lives had been touched by the judicial system, and they had never had contact with it outside of going to court. And it was touching to have those conversations with seniors and to have that connection.
Just one more comment. So I'm thinking that if you had been an incumbent and run with the incumbent behind your name, people would have said you won because you were the incumbent. But you won even though you didn't have incumbency. So incumbency is not a given that you're going to win by the amount that you won.
Senator McGuire, this was an open seat, so he was
right.
Not running.
I know, and if it hadn't been an open seat.
Well,
I
what's
that.
Very interesting in the 10th District, there was a race, and Judge Dean was here today. He's here right now. He defeated the incumbent judge, Judge Reuth, in Anoka County. I was concerned that with 24 candidates, people would just skip over the vote. And when I looked at how many people had voted, approximately 235,000 voted for the seat that Judge Dean has right now. And 255,000 voted in our race. So actually more people voted in the race with more candidates. Mm-hmm. So it actually encouraged participation, I think.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair,
Mr.
make one comment about the endorsement process? Sure. I think that will be an answer to Senator McGuire's question. Because I was endorsed by the Republican Party. They had an endorsing convention, and a number of candidates sought that endorsement. This is a real hot-button issue because it's a nonpartisan office, and the concern is that with party endorsement introduced into the process, that it thereby becomes partisan. And I understand that, and I'm not a political person. I hadn't been involved in politics. I've never run for office. I'm just not a political person. So I had my own reservations about that, and yet the endorsing convention I thought was an excellent process, and it took place over the course of 2 days and probably gave the people that attended that endorsing convention more information about at least the candidates that sought endorsement than anything else. But just on the issue of endorsement, I just want to say that, first of all, our election was a very clean election, very civil, very above the board. There was nothing negative, nothing political about it. All the discourse and debate was very civil. But the one point I want to make about endorsement is that there's really no such thing as a completely impartial person. I mean, nobody's a blank slate. Whether they declare their political affiliation or not, they still have a political leanings. They still have core values and beliefs that direct and cause them to make decisions about important issues one way or the other. So it strikes me as unfair to the voting public for them not to have that as another piece of information. If incumbency is a piece of information that is important to people, certainly what people's political views are is also important. And, I would venture to say that since the governor can appoint judicial candidates, that probably most of the judicial candidates that are recommended to the governor have similar political leanings to what the governor does. I know that Kate McPherson was one of the candidates in our election. I saw that she was appointed by Governor Dayton to become a judge. I would venture to say Governor Dayton's never going to appoint me as a judge, and that's not a criticism. It's just the way the system is, and it's part of the spoils go to the winner. So I just think that people want to know, and they have a right to know. I don't think that the fact that I had the Republican endorsement meant that they just ought to mindlessly say, all right, I'm going to vote for Chris Penwell. But it's valid information. It's important information. It did tell voters something about me, and then it was up to them to find out more about me.
Thank you. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Judge Jude, I just kind of was thinking about the fact when you were first elected, the courts had to prove the fact that you weren't too young for the office, if I recall. I'm just
curious.
Don't
have to worry about that anymore.
I was just curious if at the other end of your career, 10, 12 years from now, whenever you hit mandatory retirement age, if we might have another interesting discussion with you at both ends of the career spectrum, given the mandatory age of retirement. I thought it was just kind of an interesting thing that you could be involved in discussions of this at both ends of your career.
We probably have both been around here too long here, Senator Marty.
I think so.
We could have a long discussion about that, Senator.
Yeah, yes.
I would comment, though, on the retirement age. I, in a sense, see the judiciary as a separate, equal, and independent branch of government. And in many respects, I'd like to see the same rules apply to the judiciary as apply to the executive or apply to the legislative branch. So it's, in many ways, I'd like to see the same rules apply just because it is a separate, independent, and equal branch of government. And I think everybody has to be mindful of that all the time.
Thank you. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to follow up a little bit on the comments that Mr. Penwell just made about the party endorsement. And, I think he's brought out a very valid point, is that it's, the voters are hungry. They hunger for information. And if there is a party designation, it is a piece of information. And I think, members, we have got two candidates sitting right in front of us who ran against each other, one with party designation, one with without, and did it in a very honorable fashion. The other thing that I wanted to just comment is, you know, on this issue of party designation and the information that it imparts. As I recall, there are organizations like the police, the county attorneys, lawyers, law firms. They also endorse judicial candidates. And the thing that I've always struggled with is the party designation is sort of a nameless, faceless entity to the voters, whereas lawyers, sheriffs, police, the Chief of Police Association, law firms, when they make an endorsement, these are the folks that are actually appearing in front of the judge on a daily basis. And so to me, there's the criticism of the party designation is pretty freely given sometimes, but I really believe that maybe we ought to also be looking at other endorsements that come the way of judicial candidates and have the public and the candidates pay attention to that.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and probably more to Mr. Penwell than Judge Jude, although Judge Jude, that sounds like when you do hit that mandatory retirement age, you could kind of fit into that television judgeship. You know, Judge Jude. But both of you, I think, could speak to this. And having been part of that endorsement process, I think as somebody that was a delegate and going through that process, I think we all wanted to know that we were looking at unbiased judges, but we were really trying to talk about our core beliefs in the judge system as to whether or not somebody was a strict constructionist or strictly believed that the legislature enacts laws that they think are very well defined and whether or not there's some fuzzy edges. And I think, Mr. Penwell, you could talk about that. I don't think we ever asked you to say, are you going to overturn this or overturn that? I think we really asked your opinion on the statutes and the Constitution, didn't we?
Yes, that's a great point. I was not asked, nor would I answer questions about if you had this situation come before you as a judge, how would you rule? I don't think that's appropriate, and it's not fair game. But just basic questions about how do you handle the Constitution and, you know, what are your basic views on taxes or property rights or things of that nature ought to be fair game, because those are the kinds of decisions judges will have to make once they're on the bench, and their views of those things are important to people.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Hearing none, we'll move on to the next subject. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senators.
The next area is going to be on history of judicial standards, code of judicial conduct and ethics, and Senator Jungbauer is going to start out the conversation. And then followed up by Mr. Paul Willett and Greg Wurzel after Senator Jungbauer presents an introduction to the subject. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I will keep my comments short. I think many of us have more of a lack of information on judiciary, and that's why we have really strong feelings on that incumbency designation or things that maybe hinder people from getting information on how judges rule or people that are running for that office. And, you know, having been serving here 9 years and before that 4 years as a mayor, we always hear these different issues from our constituents. And I've heard many, many issues about judges and cases. And people always tell me that when, you know, they feel just this empty feeling when a judge rules something and they disagree with it but maybe don't have the money or the wherewithal to bring it somewhere else. And I'll just start with one simple case that I went through in district court. I won't give you the details, but the judge's ruling was exactly this. As she faced me and my attorney in district court, she said, "I find no basis in law," and that's her quote, "I find no basis in law, however, I feel as though the plaintiff has been aggrieved." And to me, you don't have to be much of a student of the law to understand that a judge takes an oath of office like we do as legislators. And if you blatantly say you're not using the law as part of your decision, I think you ought to be removed. And I've heard of many folks that have come to me and said, well, we've put complaints before the Judicial Standards Board, but these are judges that are and attorneys that are judging their peers, and so they have this tendency to not want to make an adverse decision on their peers. And I think that's normal. I think we as legislators, we don't, at least I don't want to make any harsh judgment about my peers, whether I disagree with them or not. I always try to find the good in everything, and I think that you need somebody outside to be able to judge when something's going wrong that way. And I think you need a better set of rules. The Supreme Court has come up with rules by which we they have this board on judicial standards and the rules by which we judge our judges. But I'm the chief author of a bill. We don't have the Senate version yet, but the House file is 1568. And we're looking at modifying the structure of the membership of the board by replacing the existing membership of the board with 8 legislators, 4 from each House and the Senate. So members, currently the board consists of 1 Court of Appeals judge, 3 district court judges, 2 lawyers, and 4 non-lawyer citizens. So you do have citizens there. But I think it's hard for that citizen, then again, to grasp, and I don't meet that many people that read the Constitution. However, I'm always there to provide them a copy of both the Minnesota and the U.S. Constitution so that they can read it and understand it. So I think in order to understand a complaint, I think we as legislators perhaps have a better grasp of that. And maybe I'm not so certain that that's the right makeup, but I think you need to start somewhere to change from really the attitude of the citizens that the fox is watching the hen house. So the bill doesn't specify how the members of board would be appointed, so there's a lot of work that we can do there. It also modifies the powers and authority of the Board of Judicial Standards, and it clarifies that a board may remove or retire a judge directly, and it also permits a judge to be suspended from office for a conviction or guilty or no contest plea for any crime. Right now, a judge can only be suspended for a felony-level offense or a crime involving moral turpitude, which gets to be a little fuzzy as to how people might judge that. But again, maybe it's just that I have a hardcore opinion that when a judge stands before me and says, I find no basis in law, I'm visioning that somehow after taking the oath of office, little gremlins should come out of the back room and grab that judge and haul that judge away. That is just not what they're supposed to do. They're not supposed to make a ruling based on a feeling. They're supposed to make it based on law. If they can make a ruling not based on law, then why do we need a legislator? Why would we need anybody in the legislature? Why would we need governors? That says that the judiciary is the one hand of government and the only hand of government. So members, we need to change something, and we need to have a way to make certain that judges are doing what their job is. This bill would also codify some of the existing code of judicial conduct. There are a few substantive differences. The elimination of language prohibiting judges making pledges, promises, or commitments on issues likely to come before the court. I think that's one thing we need to understand, we need to discuss, because I think judges need to be able to make broad statements. We shouldn't be able to ask them specifically how they'd rule on things, but we should know from people we're going to elect to the judgeship or even to affirm the people that are there, the incumbents, we should know broadly how they feel on the issues, and that should be fair game for all judges. Modifications on the gift ban. I don't know if you folks understand that judges can receive certain gifts in certain amounts, and certainly judges are doing that today, and I it's talked about on other edges that judges should be no different than legislators, and I think on gifts, they should be no different than legislators. We cannot accept gifts. We can accept educational materials and things like of that nature that help us in our job, but we cannot directly accept gifts. Political campaign activity. It actually changes some of the things. So some of the things that the actual rules today say a judge or judicial candidate shall not do, they're not included in this bill, specifically for a reason, because I think that we should be able to have our judges go out there and, again, tell us what they're going to do, collect campaign funds, run a significant campaign fund, not because I'm trying to kick good people out of office, not because of anything else, but when we go out there to make that vote, and I don't know about the rest of you, but I always have, hundreds of calls from people saying, who should I vote for judge? What do they stand for? And there's no way to get that information out. So if for no other reason, judges ought to be able to raise monies in order to put out campaign information about what they're doing, some of the things that they're doing, good or obviously they're going to talk about good, but we should also be able to hear the bad. And I talked about at least one person that I've heard of, and I've heard of a number of them, but judges being able to find somebody and making them remove information that they've put out there to the public about that judge's ruling, that's wrong. That's wrong. So this changes some of those things and allows judges to actually be able to be involved in political activities. And I think, again, from my perspective, and being here 9 years, next year it'll be 10 years, it's a short period of time compared to some of my peers like Senator Limmer. But I've tried to learn a lot, and I'm always open to people telling me that I'm missing something here, but that is one thing I do know, is that we really don't understand who our judges are. They need to be telling us. I do think we have a good process for picking good candidates to appoint. But from there on, if their renderings from that bench go downhill and veer away from the law, we need some way to remove them from office and remove them quickly or suspend them, and that's really what this is about. So I was going to be shorter, but I guess it took you get on your bully pulpit sometimes and spend a little bit too much time. But that's where where I'm coming from on the issue. So we can have our next folks come up.
Thank you, Senator Jungbauer. Mr. Paul DeWitt, or Willett, I'm sorry. Welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, I'm DePaul Willett, now retired, fortunately, former trial lawyer and judge and all that sort of thing. And I was with the Board of Judicial Standards as its executive secretary for 5.5 or 6 years. The reason I'm here today is I was asked to review the history of the development of the board.
Judge, would you pull the microphone closer to you?
Surely. Is that better?
We don't always magnify the sound. The microphone is used for the public record, so we'll ask you to speak just a little louder.
I'll do my best, and if I'm not, yell at me.
I wouldn't yell at you, Judge.
Before I get into the history itself, there are, I think, four things that people who deal with judges in terms of their conduct and decisions is, first of all, there has to be a distinction between function. In other words, the person who is investigating something or who is acting as a judge, the legislator represents the constituency of people who have specific desires in terms of policy and construction. A judge's job is to judge. And the two functions are quite different, and I think they have to be kept in mind when dealing with the code and the rules for discipline. Having said that, the goal of having an independent judiciary is to protect the public. So we have a difference in function, and we have a difference in end goal. So all of the things I'm going to talk about today, it would be helpful, I think, in understanding them to keep in mind this distinction. And I think the role of the judge, I couldn't say better than the first canon of the code, and I'm going to read that. A judge shall uphold and promote the independence, integrity, and impartiality of the judiciary, and shall avoid improprieties and appearance of improprieties. That's a very high standard. And I think it's, again, getting back to the function of a legislator or the public opposing the board members, it makes a difference. I thought I would start out by, I hope you have the material from the Minnesota Bar book. It deals with the limitation of our process in dealing with judges up until nearly the turn of the century, and that is the only way a judge could be disciplined prior to the adoption of the code and the rules was by a constitutional limitation of impeachment. And the only case Minnesota has had in that experience was a man by the name of Julian Cox, who back in 1883 was charged with drunkenness, visiting a house of ill repute, and there was a four-month trial. There were articles of impeachment were sent to the Senate, and the Senate held a hearing which lasted, as I said, 4 months. There were 160 witnesses, 1,700 pages of testimony, and Julian Cox was impeached. Now, the reason that's significant is it shows how cumbersome the impeachment process is and why around the turn of the century from the late 1890s up until the 20s, people were looking around for another way of handling judge discipline. The interesting thing about Judge Cox was that he went to the legislature and they expunged the impeachment. And so Minnesota technically stands, we've never had a conviction of any kind under the impeachment statute. So in the 20s, ethical standards were a significant factor. The American Bar Association and other agencies were working on a simpler method of dealing with ethics and judges. In 1924, there were ethical guidelines issued by the American Bar Association, and also, but it did not contain any basis for discipline. In 1944, the Minnesota Supreme Court adopted and set up a judicial council, which became a worked on a study by Maynard Persig. Some of you who are of my age might remember that name. He was a very popular professor at the University of Minnesota. And he determined that there was no judicial reason or rule reason that the Supreme Court could not make rules dealing with the question of judicial ethics. And that was in 44. Nothing really happened of it. There was a proposed bill in the study, but it never went anywhere. By the 1970s, however, 22 states had adopted constitutional amendments to provide for the agency review of judicial conduct and to provide for discipline. No state had adopted by the legislature a code of conduct. There is no state has adopted, or no legislature has adopted that in this country, at least according to the American Judicature Society. Not letting this activity with the Bar Association die without action, in 1968, Chief Judge Knutson made a suggestion with the district judges that really we should do something to establish some general standards for judge conduct. And the chief judge issued an order on his own appointing a commission on judicial responsibility to deal with that, and the purpose was to was done in February 1970, and the Chief Justice's order created a commission on judicial responsibility, which would counsel and advise all judges of the state with respect to their conduct, participation in non-judicial activities. This was all voluntary on the part of the judiciary in Minnesota. However, there's no provision for discipline. It was just guidelines. In 1971, the Constitution adopted rules to investigate and hearing before the commission. In March of 1972, the Supreme Court adopted a code for judicial conduct based on the American Bar Association Model Code. At the same time, the legislature created a commission on judicial standards, and the rules were to be made by the Supreme Court. Now, this required an amendment to the state constitution because there was no provision in the Constitution for disciplining judges or removing them. So as a result of the activities of the Bar Association Supreme Court adopting the Code on Judicial Conduct and the rules, there was an amendment to the Constitution which provided for a state agency funded by the legislature, rules made by the Minnesota Supreme Court. This is all controlled by a 10-person board, and the governor appoints all of the members of the board except the judiciary, judge, or the lawyers. Now, most recently, there was an amendment to the Model Code of the American Bar Association. So in 2007, in a 3.5-year process, the entire code was reviewed, promulgated a new code after 3.5 years of work. The committee was comprised of judges, lawyers, academicians, and public members. And even more recently, the ABA model was again studied by the Bar Association 2 years ago and adopted extensive hearings. The Supreme Court held public hearings and received comments with very little objection from the public comment when the hearings were held around the state and in the Supreme Court, and there was very little input adverse to the action taken. So to be a little repetitive, what we have at this time is, as I said, a state agency, which is the Board on Judicial Standards. It's funded by the legislature. It provides specifically that the rules will be made by the Supreme Court, which has been done. The board which controls the conduct of the membership of the board, is a 10-person. They have, someone mentioned it earlier, 2 lawyers, 4 public members, and 4 judges. And all of the persons are appointed by the governor except the judges or the judicial personnel. So that's how we got to where we are today. That's the history. And if there are any questions, I'll attempt to answer them.
Again, thank you, Judge. We're going to hold questions until the next witness is done, and then we'll open
okay.
it up.
Shall I stay here then?
You can, if you'd like. Right. Mr. Wurzel, welcome back. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
senators. Again, it's Greg Wersel, W-E-R-S-A-L. I did want to do just a few housekeeping items to make sure everyone has the correct information. The word incumbent does appear on the ballot in other states. I know of at least two off the top of my head. One is California, the other is Idaho, and I haven't completed my research, so there may be additional states. Senator McGuire was kind enough to ask me about the word incumbent, and I want to clarify that it doesn't matter to me. If the word incumbent actually works against the candidate, that's still a problem too, because what we're supposed to have is a fair playing field. We're not supposed to be trying to stack the deck either for or against one of the candidates. So if you think at all that that word might affect the way voters see this election and how they react to the election, then it should probably be eliminated from the ballot. With regard to the Board on Judicial Standards, the bill that's proposed, I'm going to give you again my perspective as an attorney who's practiced law for over 30 years. I have filed ethical complaints against judges with the Board on Judicial Standards. I might just as well have thrown them in the wastebasket. It's like it's a black hole in which complaints seem to go into and in which you never really seem to get a response. All of their hearings are, the public is excluded, including even the complainant. So you have no idea what they're doing, what their decisions are, what the outcome is. And most surprisingly, I guess, was the fact that I would file complaints and never be asked a follow-up question, never be asked to come and testify, never be asked for why I said what I said in my complaint. Just amazing. Another problem with the way this is set up is the influence of the Minnesota Supreme Court. And I want you to understand this process a little bit better. And you need to look at Article 6 of the Minnesota Constitution, Section 9, which deals with retirement, removal, and discipline. It in part says the legislature may also provide for the retirement, removal, or other discipline of any judge who is disabled, incompetent, or guilty of conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice. No other branch of government, including the Minnesota Supreme Court, has that delegation of power. Only the legislature has been given the power to remove or discipline a judge. Now, the first thing you did in furtherance of that constitutional provision was you enacted Minnesota Statute 490A, which set up the Board on Judicial Standards. And if you look at that bill or that language as it now stands and go to the last provision of the current language, which is I believe subdivision 7, it says the Minnesota Supreme Court will make rules to implement this section, and that's how the Minnesota Supreme Court got the authority to issue the Code on Judicial Conduct. Now, the only problem is that what you've done is literally put the foxes in charge of the hen house, and they've mucked it up, to be honest. And I want to give you an example, some of the examples of how they've mucked it up, and especially with regard to judicial elections. When I first ran for office, the Minnesota Supreme Court, which was back in 1998, the Minnesota Supreme Court had created a rule. It was found in Canon 5 at the time, which stated that judicial candidates could not state their views on legal and political issues. Now, if you couldn't state your view on a legal or political issue, it's no doubt that the public was not going to get any information from you on your views on legal and political issues. And that's one of the reasons the public was getting no information. I also challenged several other rules at the same time. One of them was a rule that prohibited judicial candidates from personally soliciting campaign funds. And if you can't raise campaign funds, well, is it any, it's quite obvious you're not going to have money to spend on literature and other means to get your message out to the voters. And again, the voters will not have any information. Another rule prohibited judicial candidates from seeking the endorsement of a political party. At the time, the rules permitted judicial candidates to seek the endorsement of any other group, including not only unions, police, but also single-interest interest groups. So, for instance, the judicial candidate could seek the endorsement of a pro-abortion group or a pro-life group, and the court saw no problem with that. But a group called the Republican Party or the Democrat Party that might have individuals who are both inside of the party who were both pro-life and pro-abortion, they couldn't seek that endorsement. So we started a lawsuit that went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And in 2002, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the provision that prohibited judicial candidates from stating their views on legal and political issues. They also struck down a provision that prohibited judicial candidates, they then referred the balance of the issues back down to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. And in 2006, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals struck down, I think, four more provisions, but the ones that are most important are they struck down a provision that prohibited judicial candidates from personally soliciting campaign funds and from seeking political party endorsement. Within only a few months after that decision, the Minnesota Supreme Court went back and started tinkering with the rules again. And they created yet another new rule that said a judicial candidate can personally solicit campaign funds, but only if there are 20 or more people in the audience. The number 20 was pulled right out of the air. It makes it almost, again, impossible for anyone to run for these positions because you cannot raise the money, especially when you have to overcome, from my perspective, that incumbency designation. I, again, started another lawsuit to challenge that. We had a decision from the Eighth Circuit three-judge panel in 2010 that struck down that provision, but that decision has been withdrawn because the court has granted what's called en banc consideration, which means all 18 or 20 judges or whatever is on the Eighth Circuit are going to consider it. We had oral argument, I believe it was in February of this year, and we do not yet have a decision on whether that's going to be struck down. Now, the one thing we want to do is we want to preserve an impartial judiciary. I'm not opposed to an impartial judiciary, but I also want to have accountability and I want to have working elections. And Senator Youngbauer mentioned that he had eliminated the Pledge and Promise Clause that says that candidates can't make pledges and promises. But I want you to understand that's not entirely what occurs in this bill. It says we're trying to create a bill where candidates will have as much free speech. Did I say yes? Yes, as much free speech as possible. Free speech is guaranteed by the First Amendment of the Constitution. We shouldn't be trying to limit free speech. What we should be trying to do is make sure that we get an impartial justice and fair justice. And so there's actually a provision in this proposed code that says that it's on Section 7, Subdivision 1, 3, which says a judge or candidate for judicial office shall not engage in political or campaign activity that is inconsistent with the independence, integrity, or impartiality of the judiciary.
Mr. Worsell?
Yes.
We don't have that particular
document
in front of us. That's a House bill. And
I'm sorry.
It's been filed.
I'm sorry.
Senate, so
it's my fault. Let me tell.
And you're down to about a half a minute left.
Very good. Let me tell you this, though. There is a provision in the bill which says when a judge must recuse himself. And if you read that, we've added a provision into that that isn't found in the current code that says that when if a judge has made pledges or promises, he must recuse himself from the case. That's how you ensure justice and impartiality. You don't do it at the front end by limiting free speech in the election. You do it in the courtroom by getting that judge to get off the case. I'll conclude my remarks there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wurzel. We're now open for questions on this section. Any questions from the members? We must have worn everybody out by the testimony.
Now, could I add one, Senator, could I add one more comment?
Yes, sir.
Again, I didn't mention this earlier, but to that separation of function between representing a constituency for legislative purposes and someone who judges is, I didn't mention cash, and that is another overriding consideration in judicial races, is the infusion of cash. And the case which the United States Supreme Court heard a year ago about what was really in effect the purchase of a judge by a $1 million contribution to his reelection fund demonstrates the kind of problems that we have in the future. And it's compounded by the fact that Justice O'Connor, after joining the majority in that case, ruled with the change in personnel that permits unlimited money to be spent in campaigns, now admits it was not a good decision. It's a little late. So some of the consideration has to be made about the infusion of cash, and that is primarily why the CUI group has been active in attempting to frame an operational framework that would minimize that effect. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judge. I had a question, Judge. You had made a comment referring to the legislature moving away from a reliance on an impeachment authority adopting a judicial standard board. And the reason that you had mentioned was that the impeachment process was cumbersome. Could you extrapolate on the cumbersome nature of an impeachment?
Probably more in the context of when it occurred in 1883 than it would be today. But it was simply the mass of effort taken by a legislative body that certainly had a lot of other legislative problems on their table, and the amount of time and effort was spent on this particular disciplinary problem. I hope that clarifies what I meant by my statement.
All right. 1883. Thank you. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really have more of a couple of comments than a question. The legislature has completely abdicated its authority in the oversight of judges. By handing off the responsibility to standards boards, to other people, to folks that are within the system, has virtually assured the fact that there won't be proper policing of the judiciary. And the legislature ought to collectively be ashamed of that. If judges truly make a comment from the bench that they're ignoring the law and going with their feelings, they ought to be dragged in front of this committee and asked about it. And unfortunately, I don't think that happens, because obviously that's not very politically popular. Of course, the judiciary is not without fault either. The judiciary has taken on a much more significant role in our society than it should have, through asserting itself overly aggressively in the area of judicial review and other things that called to mind the Federalist 78, which I hadn't read for a long time. But I went back and found this quote that I think will make people understand the difference in the view that our founding fathers had of the role of the judiciary in comparison to what we see them do today, as there are marches on our Supreme Court rather than our legislatures to change the law. This from the Federalist 78. The judiciary, on the contrary, has no influence over either the sword or the purse, no direction either of the strength or of the wealth of society, and can take no active resolution whatever. It may truly be said to have neither force nor will, but merely judgment, and must ultimately depend upon the aid of the executive arm for the efficacy of its judgments. So the problem we have here is judges are too significant, which is why how we select them and how we discipline them and how we review their performance has become far more important than it ought to be. And until the judiciary is willing to see its role as less significant in our society, and until legislatures are willing to do the politically difficult thing and ask judges about the decisions that they make, we'll never solve the problem.
Mr. Chair, and members on that issue, Senator Thompson makes a great point, and that specifically to the judiciary has no control over the purse. And we've seen in the state of Minnesota itself where when we can't come to a resolution on our budget, the judiciary grabs the purse and starts telling people what should be spent and what should not be spent, which has never, never, never been the role of the judiciary in this society, in this country. That is wrong, wrong, wrong. On the cash end, if you start talking about cash buying influence, then every election has been bought in terms of influence with cash. That's ludicrous. That's as bad as, and I'm sorry, Senator Marty, but, you know, your bill, I think, went too far in limiting things as though a lunch would buy influence over a decision in terms of the legislature or something else. And I think Mr. Wurzel has a great comment on the cash end as well, if you would indulge.
Senator McGuire has a question.
Okay.
I was just going to actually make a comment. Excuse me. I'm just encouraged by the debate that we're having about the, you know, balance of powers and the three branches of government. You know, it's not surprising that a legislative branch would want to question the power of the other branches. And so I think it's good that we have a discussion about what our role is, what the judicial role is, and what the executive branch role is. And so I just point that out, that it is important to have that, but I think it's not surprising that we might question, you know, what their power is, but we need to be careful that we respect that there are three branches of government and that they each have their own role.
Good point.
Senator McGuire, it's always good to go back to our job description as it was originally written and see what our job was. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To Senator McGuire's point, I certainly don't lack respect for the judiciary. I'm a licensed attorney, have been for 24 years, and have done a lot of litigation, been in front of numerous Article III judges as well as administrative law judges. So that being said, I respect the people more than I respect any branch of the government, and the people deserve to have government administered in the way that our Constitution sets forth. That's my concern. I have really no bias against the judiciary or the legislature, and I've even been nice to the governor today. So I'm really being a good guy.
Mr. Wurzel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to address the cash issue, campaign money. That is a serious concern. And I don't think we should belittle it, but I do want you to understand that the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals did strike down as unconstitutional a provision that prohibited judicial candidates from personally soliciting campaign funds, and they struck it down because they said it violated the First Amendment free speech. And again, the Supreme Court simply created yet one more rule that says you can't solicit unless you have 20 or more people in your audience. And I think, like I said, the Eighth Circuit three-judge panel also struck that rule down. What we have actually, you will find in your bill, is that we're trying to deal with this problem, and it says that the candidate can solicit campaign contributions, but not from attorneys or others who are likely to appear before the candidate's court. If there is any group that is likely to have influence over a judge, trust me, ladies and gentlemen, it's and who wants to buy justice, it's the attorneys who appear in courtrooms. And again, if you look at history and you go back and start looking at who gives money to judicial campaigns, you will find that most of the money, I'm going to venture 80%, comes from law firms giving money to the incumbents. And you have to ask yourself, why? Why is all this money flowing to the incumbents, and why is it coming from law firms? And my suggestion to you, that is dangerous, and we need to change that. If we do nothing else, we need to stop that practice. And I hope, again, you'll take a serious look at these provisions.
Any further questions?
One more comment.
Senator McGuire.
Just one more comment, Mr. Chair, because we've had a lot of discussion now about the money that's involved in politics, and I would agree that there's too much money involved in all races. And so I would not say that we should make the judicial races similar to our own, because there's too much money involved in our races also. So we just have to watch that in every race that there is out there. And we do need to be careful. And we know there are instances where big money has supported non-incumbents and put people that believe the way they do into judicial positions. So we definitely know there's situations where that has occurred. So it does go both ways, and I think we all need to be really conscious of the money that's involved in getting people elected to any office or any judicial spot. And so I think that's a really big issue that we should be tackling.
Any further questions, Mr. Wurzel?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, but I want you to think about how you would run for your office if you could not personally solicit campaign funds, because that's what you're asking judicial candidates to do in this state.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Judge.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, I can only say the 6 years that I had the position of looking at judge conducts, I never found a single judge who wanted to know who contributed to their campaigns. Why? Because they understand, as we all do, that it influences what we do. And I can't recall of any judge that ever expressed any opinion other than I don't want to know. And the way to accomplish that very simply is to have a committee. Let the committee raise the funds rather than face-to-face solicitation. But thank you. Okay.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Hearing none, this hearing is concluded. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Great.